Cool. Matt Thomas, thanks for being on, man. I'm really excited about this conversation.
Me too, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. To get started, I could easily go into your background and all the stuff that you've done, which is a lot, with reality TV, chess boxing, which, what the hell is that? We'll get into that. All the coaching you've done, Brawl for Calls, Fight and Flow, building a personal brand like you have. Like, you've done a lot of really cool stuff. If you don't mind, can you give listeners just a little background of, what's the bio of Matt Thomas? How'd we get here?
Yeah, thanks. And would love to dig into all the above. I guess the short version, when I introduce myself, I say I'm a health and wellness entrepreneur. Okay. So especially with the businesses that I'm currently involved with, it's all in movement and mindfulness. For most of my 20s, I was a fight promoter. So I did some professional fights, but mostly focused on amateur boxing through the lens of a nonprofit I started in college called Brawl for a Cause. We do charity boxing events for first-timers, people that don't belong in the ring, but decide to put themselves there in order to fight for a charity that they personally believe in. So something that's affected them, affected their family, a community that they're a part of. They're willing to get punched in the face in order to raise some funds and awareness for that. We're willing to train them, invite a bunch of people to watch them, and it's a lot of fun.
And these are just normal people, right?
Normal people, yeah. So, I mean, it started as like a college event, so I was matching fraternity guys against fraternity guys, and they're beating the crap out of each other after, you know, taking a shot of Jaeger or something. But it grew and evolved and got more refined. So our last two events were Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta and the Georgia World Congress Center. We have CEOs, celebrities, cops, firefighters, school teachers, like all walks of life sign up to fight in this. And it's everyday people literally fighting for what they believe in.
How's COVID affected that? Have you been able to do any fights?
Yeah, so we had a big event scheduled for May 2nd, 2020, and it had to be canceled. So we're still working through, like, we don't have all of our deposit money back from vendors. COVID hit us hard, so we got knocked down, but we're getting back up. We have something planned for later this year. Prior to COVID, most of my income was coming from like 7 or 8 big live events that I did every year. And that COVID coming in and clearing space created a lot of opportunity to look at that and be like, okay, you know, this was my 20s and I love live events and I love bringing people together. If I have all this space and time, how can I use this differently? And is that better aligned for my present and future?
Yeah, I'd imagine that. What were some of the better fights? Is it like I'd imagine the CEOs getting in there and all the employees wanting to show up to see their boss get punched in the face?
Yeah, so we divide our fight card into 3 types of fights. One is like a fundraiser fight. So the CEOs typically fall in that one. They're old dudes. They typically don't they aren't physical specimens. So the fights aren't like necessarily explosive or exciting like our second category is. But they're important because we're a fundraising event before we're anything else. We want to raise funds and awareness for the charities that we're supporting. And even if you watch kind of like a sloppy, boring fight, you're doing a lot of good. So about a third of our fights are tailored towards that. Like, they have great networks. They have great people to fundraise from, companies to sponsor them, that kind of thing. Second one is more of your like ex-athlete, personal trainer. Like, they have pretty good networks. They're definitely in it because they want to train for something. They miss training for something. They want to challenge themselves. They haven't boxed before. And so, like, as that bracket has evolved, we've had ex-NFL athletes, we've had, freaks of nature in terms of, like, the NFL's fastest man and a 3-time Pro Bowler fought in our 2018 event. It's like watching him, like, wrap his head around boxing and get in there and try to knock someone out is like, a sight to behold. And those are usually the exciting fights. So we'll try to break up some of the boring fundraising fights with the exciting athletic fights. The last one are really like cause focused. They're strong stories. So and that's my favorite bracket. Those are the ones that are most important to broadcast. They, you know, one example is we've had a 24-year-old single mom fighting for her disabled daughter's leg surgery so that she could walk. 24-year-old single mom does not have a strong network. She is not a physical specimen, and she deserves all of the support and attention that she can get because, she's a real life superhero the way that she's fighting for her daughter. So putting her as our co-main event, I can definitely go deeper into the story, but she walked into the ring having raised $3,000 from her family and network. She walked out of the ring with over $10,000 just 6 minutes later.
That's awesome.
Because of the people in the room live by donating after hearing her story. Mm. So that's part of the power of Brawl for a Cause is you can watch a complete stranger fight for what they believe in and be inspired to generosity. And our mission is to inspire $1 billion worth of generosity.
And when you do the events, do you have a network that you plug into to help promote it, of influencers and people?
It's built over the last 9 years. So in 2012, did the first Bulldog Brawl event, which evolved into Brawl for a Cause. Mm. And since 2012, over 300 people have fought. Over 100 charities have been benefited. So we've built a substantial list of people that have been directly involved with the event, of charities that have received a check from the event, and of we have an email list of 25,000 people that have been involved in some capacity, either as an attendee or as a donor. So that's part of the power of signing up for this, as opposed to doing another traditional kind of fundraiser. You can do a 5K, you can do a bake sale, you can do a car wash, but if you really want to make an impact, pun always intended, then Brawl for a Cause is a good option.
That's incredible. Yeah, I mean, that must feel amazing when you get to help people like that. I can't imagine. And you've got a lot of fighting in your background too, right? You did, so first of all, chess boxing, right? Like I want to understand what came first. Cause you were also on a reality TV, like a reality TV show. What was, did Brawl for a Cause come before all these other things? Or did you get into chess boxing and reality TV beforehand? What was the chronological order there?
Yeah. So chess boxing happened in, Brawl for a Cause happened in college. So, I grew up doing Taekwondo. My mom didn't love the idea of me competing in Taekwondo. So I really never did. I did some like practice sparring and that kind of thing, but I never went to like competitions. But one of the ways that I asserted my independence in college is I joined the club boxing team, adapted the striking background from Taekwondo to boxing, and then started competing against other colleges. So I went to University of Georgia. We would go to Georgia Tech or Clemson or Florida, University of Florida, and we would box their club team. And they were unofficial matches. So I got a lot of off the record experience through those. So because they weren't sanctioned, I didn't get a record, but I got a lot of live action. A few fights under my belt before I had my first official fight. So that's really when the boxing journey started for me. I was 19 and in college. I had grown up playing competitive chess, and chess is my favorite pastime. So people play video games or watch Netflix or whatever. I'm usually playing online chess. Mm. And so in my first ever official amateur boxing bout, I dislocated my shoulder. I popped it back in, ended up winning the fight, but I needed a shoulder surgery. And so a few years later, I finally got the surgery. And as I was recovering from the surgery, I was watching a lot of YouTube and playing a lot of online chess. And YouTube served me a video that was chess boxing. So the sidebar where it's next up. I didn't even click the video. It auto-played a video of chess boxing, which is how I found out about the sport. Mm-hmm. And so it blew my mind. I was these are my two favorite things. And I just got this surgery on my shoulder so that I could fight again. Because it was coming out all the time. Like, I wasn't able to fight in the years between the injury and after I got the surgery. So, so I was like, this is, it felt like fate. I mean, it felt like destiny of just like, I think I'm made for this sport. And so while I was recovering from the shoulder surgery, I reached out to the founder of Chess Boxing, Jeppe. And it's this Dutch guy who was living in Berlin and building chess boxing out of Berlin. And I was just like, hey, you know, I want to be involved. I'm a fight promoter here in the States, and I don't see any events in the States. So if you want help bringing it here, cool. If you just want another participant, like, I'm down for that too. And he said, why don't you fight first so you get a taste of the sport, and then we can talk about expansion. I said, okay. I'm at least a year out from being able to fight just after the surgery. So about a year and a half later, I reconnect with him. I said, hey, I'm ready. And he said, the only event we have the rest of the year is the World Championship. And I was like, I think I'll pass, like, maybe next year. Because, like, I hadn't fought in a few years. And I was rusty in chess. And like, the prospect of going to fight, like, the best people in the world at this was a little too much right out of the gate. So I was like, thanks, but no thanks. And he was like, well, you know, at least sleep on it. Because if you sign up for this World Championship, you'll be the first American in history to fight in the World Championship. And you'd be wearing the red, white, and blue and representing your country and all that kind of stuff. And so that kind of got tossed around in my head a little bit. I was like, you know, even if I go over there and get my ass kicked, at least I'm the first American to do it. So,
of course.
I ended up signing up. But I guess I should back up a little bit. So chess boxing is the board game chess combined with the combat sport boxing. And so you throw them together, you alternate rounds between the two until there's either checkmate or knockout. So round one is on the chessboard, you're playing speed chess, making a move, hitting your timer, and your opponent does the same. As soon as 3 minutes is up, you have a minute in between rounds to put on your gloves, psych yourself up, and get ready to fight, and then the next round is boxing. So you're punching each other in the body, you're knocking each other in the head for 3 minutes. Assuming you survive, you got another minute to take off your gloves, sit back down on the board, and pick up the game where you left off.
So it's 3 minutes of chess and 3 minutes of boxing and 3 minutes of chess and 3 minutes of boxing. It just goes like that until someone gets knocked out or loses?
Yeah, so there's three definitive endings. Part of the reason why I love the sport is there's always a definitive end. So, you know, you see a lot of, like, corruption, especially in boxing these days, where it's like, you know, right corner won that fight. Anyone watching could see that red corner won that fight, and for some reason blue corner has their hand raised. Like, what's going on? Like, what were the judges paid? What fight were they watching? That kind of thing. So there's never, like, a decision. There's never a subjective judge being like, that guy won. Because it's either going to be checkmate. You know, one color pieces on the chessboard, trapping the other king, so the king can't move, and that's the end of the game. The time can run out on the chessboard, and that actually happens a lot because it's a low time, so time pressure is always there, which makes for more exciting chess. You aren't sitting there watching a five-hour game. You're seeing people having to move quickly, making mistakes, seeing the mistakes or missing the mistakes, both of which are exciting, and it leading to, you know, faster pace intellectual warfare. And then the last is knockout or TKO. So you can either get three stoppages in a round or four in a fight to count as a TKO, or you can knock them out. They don't get back up for 10 seconds. You win.
So you're actually hitting the clock, like, on the, when you're playing the chess, like, you're doing the whole, you know, Bobby Fischer, hit the timer,
and move on to the next one. Yeah, you've seen Queen's Gambit and that blitz chess that they play, the fast pace, like, move, hit, move, hit, move, hit with one hand, same thing.
Yeah, so I'm not like, I love chess and I like playing chess, but I'm not like a huge, I've never been trained professionally or I've never been trained even remotely in playing, but I do play with the timer. We just got a timer. I got like the timer app on my phone, and I'll play with my father, a couple of my buddies, and it adds such a layer of anxiety to the game. I can't imagine having, like, knowing, like, okay, I have my time limit here that I have to keep hitting and playing against the time via chess, but then I'm going to get punched in the face in 3 minutes.
Right? Yeah, I mean, in my mind, and of course I'm biased, but I think it's the ultimate form of competition. Because not only are you competing in two antithetical expressions, you know, the brain and the brawn, chess and boxing, you're also competing in state change. You have to switch your mind and body from, you know, a high adrenaline, high heart rate state to a very calm, very cerebral pattern recognition kind of state. So that minute in between rounds, you're competing just as much as you are in those 3 minute boxing or chess rounds.
That's interesting. Have you used any of the chess boxing in the Brawl for a Cause? Have you had any chess boxing competitions there?
No, we've actually only had one big event since I got involved in the sport. So my first year was 2018, competing in the World Championship, and then I competed in 2019.
Okay.
So we only had our 2019 event since being involved with chess boxing. I think in the near future, I'll probably feature an exhibition just to help the sport grow. I don't think... I you know, that's just because I'm involved in it, though. It's not because, like, you know, the Americans are craving chess boxing. I don't think many people know about it yet, so.
But it's so unique. I mean, I would be drawn to keeping an eye on a chess boxing tournament between, like, CEO of whatever and the CFO of something else, something along those lines. And I bet you those guys, from a training perspective, that adaptability, like you said, that state change, there's probably some really cool things you can do in the training.
I think it could turn into another bracket. Yeah. I think it's already a huge time commitment just trying to learn how to box. So adding chess training to that would be a lot. Yeah. But that's not to say, like, people look for a lot. You know, people want challenges, especially the CEO achiever types. So I see potential in that too. I don't think it's quite there yet, but I think it will be there in the near future.
Put me on the list.
Nice. Okay.
I already enjoy
on this too.
Yeah, dude, I bet you a lot of people would sign up for that, especially if it's for a good cause. Why not? And you learn how to box. I don't know anything. I don't know how to box. I don't know how to, you know, the only fight training I've had has been, just like very, very basic martial arts, hand-to-hand combat stuff that we did. But it's nothing, right? It's like nothing compared to what most people understand. And but what we did, what I have learned is certain tactics on, they call it adaptability quotient. Mm. Have you heard of that line before?
I've heard of the phrase, but...
Yeah, it's like it's transitional stuff. When you're going from one thing to another, there's always a moment of pause. You can't have the same mindset for the most part, switching tasks or going from, you know, driving your car to getting out and going and sitting in a meeting or something along those lines. There's always an adaptability quotient that's involved in that transition. Mm. So, so I've done some training with that. The last time I did it was, I actually talked about it, the guy that trained me on this podcast once before. It was, he mixed in martial arts with, firearms. So live firearms. So you'd have to go from, you know, slowly defeating an opponent in front of you and then pull out a gun and actually have that real risk of, you know, maybe shooting your trainer accidentally, but then actually being able to having to shoot targets.
Cool.
And that was that transitional stuff. But I found that that transition training was really cool and helpful, especially with, like, I have a young family, you know, and it going from work to family, from work to family. You know, that type of training is really important. Really powerful.
We're constantly state changing, whether we acknowledge it or not. The more conscious of it and intentional we can be about it, the better. And I think that's one of the biggest takeaways from chess boxing is, especially when I was competing, I was not the best chess player. I was not the best boxer. Mm. But what I endeavored to be the best at was that minute in between rounds.
That's interesting. How did you get there? I know that you've done quite a bit of meditation retreats and a lot of mindfulness stuff. Like you said in the beginning, that's one of your, the way you introduce yourself. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. So through the lens of chess boxing, I use two breaths from yogic pranayama. So it's on the one hand, when you want to prime yourself and psych yourself up and get ready to perform, I use a breath called Kapalabhati or fire breath. And have you ever seen, like, Wim Hof? do his thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wim Hof uses a variation of Kabbalah Vati. So he does it through his mouth, and in yoga traditionally it's done through the nose, but it's rapid force compressions of the abdomen so that you're kind of pushing and moving all of your organs around, and that releases adrenaline. And then you're also force inhaling and exhaling so that you're getting a lot of oxygen in your bloodstream into your brain. So you're getting a lot of fuel into all these motors that are ready to fire off. And so I do that right before a boxing round, but I also do it right before I do any sort of physical training so that my body knows, hey, it's time to perform. So it's a degree of priming both for when in actual competition. It helps on a base level of just having more oxygen and being in fight or flight. But it also helps with training so that I can basically signal to my brain and my body that it's time to do a certain activity before it really knows it's time. So that's the one primer. The other one is a cooling, grounding kind of breath, and that's called Samasvriti. And they use this in the armed forces. It's called box breathing, but it's designed to lower the heart rate and lower the adrenal state. So calming yourself down in extremely stressful situations. And it can take a couple different forms. The form that I do is 4-count inhale, 4-count hold, 4-count exhale, 4-count hold. But there's people that leave off the bottom hold, so empty lung hold. So they'll do something like 4-7-8. So 4-second inhale, 7-second hold, 8-second exhale. But the important part is that you're exhaling about as long or longer than you inhale. That's one of the signals to your central nervous system that it's okay to calm down. And second, just the act of controlling breath, of counting, it helps psychologically let you know that you're in control, that your breath isn't in control of you, that something isn't happening to you, that you're happening to it. So those are the two breaths I use before a boxing or a chest round. And those came from a yoga teacher training. So I'm a Lululemon ambassador, and I was afforded the opportunity to do a 200-hour yoga teacher training through Lululemon with 50 staff and ambassadors from around the world. And it was a life-changing experience, awesome people, a really great instructor, the head of Vedic and Asana for the Chopper Center, a woman named Danielle Mika Nagel, is who led it. And going deep into breath work or pranayama, and that was like, hey, these, they've been used for thousands of years for all kinds of things. Like, none of this stuff is new, but it can be adapted to a more modern Western world. Like, you can use this in the workplace. You can use this, in athletic pursuits. You can use this day to day when you have a stressful situation with your partner or your parents or whatever. And that's what led to co-founding a corporate wellness company right at the beginning of COVID was people are going to need breath work and meditation. And right now they can't get it by going to a yoga studio. They can't get it by going into their office and their company's providing it. They need to be served it at home. Mm-hmm. So we built a virtual product. And it's our main thing is 15-second live virtual sync ups for desk stretching, breath work, and guided meditation.
And it's scheduled each day. So every day, 15.
The big win and what's gotten us traction and referrals and organic growth is that it's live. And companies will buy, 2,000 licenses to Headspace so that all of their employees have access to it. But because they always have access to it, they never use it. And the benefit of a live session that's put onto your calendar by your boss, who's also going to be there, is
show up.
It actually gets used because it's encouraged by the company. It's already permissible. Like, it's your boss gave you the permission by inviting you to the calendar event, and it's happening live. So you get better energy than going back to the video library afterwards and watching a recording. Because you can interact in the chat with your teammates or your employees. So it turns into like a virtual water cooler meets, a health and wellness session.
That's awesome. When did you start that?
So my partner's been in corporate wellness for 14 years. Okay. So she had to do a big pivot about April of last year. Yeah. And that's when we started working together. And then I officially joined the business as an equal partner in the fall after about 6 months of kind of dating each other and helping each other out.
So it was really just watching COVID not going away. And then what was the main inspiration of saying, let's put this into action full force?
Yeah, a couple things. I thought it would be a good way to fill that void I talked about before with like, hey, these yep. events that I'm usually doing at this time aren't happening. So I can help her with this business and maybe be an advisor, or maybe, help with biz dev and like do this until I can do my other things again. Mm. COVID continued, as we know, and habits from COVID are going to stay. But more people are going to be working from home, even if it's not as many. Mm. People are still going to be working from home, and companies are building infrastructure so that that's a viable reality. And people like working from home. So it's also going to be a recruiting and retention tool to be able to have virtual roles in companies and service to virtual employees. So we're building currently to be able to lead these through Zoom and do this kind of like video conferencing thing. But our real play is to be early movers in the virtual reality space. Mm. So when you plug into an Oculus or when, whatever the next version of it is, whether you're wearing eyeglasses or contacts, when you want to do a facilitated breathwork or meditation session, we want it to be us.
Dude, talk about adaptability or making those transitions. I mean, VR isn't going away, and it's getting bigger and bigger, and it's going to get bigger in the workplace. Sooner or later, you're going to be doing a lot of stuff with goggles on. You're going to need to take them off and interact with the real world.
It's already happening. I mean, it's just suboptimal technology right now. It's a bulky headset with a relatively high price point. But like, as you know, like in the 80s, the only people using computers were gazillionaires.
Right.
And 10 years later, everyone has one in their house. So VR is going to follow a very similar trajectory. The first week that the Oculus Quest 2 came out, I got it. I invite people over every week to play Beat Saber or to go through the tutorial. I've probably sold 50 Oculus sets. There's not someone that I've had try it at my house that hasn't immediately taken action on it, whether it's like buying Facebook stock or buying an Oculus or researching how their company can be adapted to VR. Like it's powerful technology.
Dude, it is. It's going to make its way to more education. It's going to make its way to more corporate events and meetings and the event space. Holy shit. Like it's going to take over the event space for sure.
The new general admission ticket is going to be VR.
Yeah, dude, absolutely. That stuff's fascinating. So I know the box breathing. I've done that plenty of times. In fact, I keep telling myself to get back into that routine. In 2020, it like saved my brain, I feel like. And I've done the Wim Hof, but I'm interested in how long, like what is the first, can you describe that first breathing meditation that you do with that breathing exercise a little bit more?
Yeah. So, let's say there's three levels to it. The first is the traditional, what it's for, which is clearing the windpipe. It's called a skull shining breath. So like think about what it would look and feel like to like, scrub and shine your skull. That's what the breath is supposed to feel like. So you're doing forced compressions through the nose and flexing your abs at the same time. So it's, et cetera. So in the minute in between rounds for chest boxing, I go for 108 of those breaths. So three sets of 36. After 36 breaths, I'll take a full breath in, full breath out, half breath in, and begin again. Second.
How long does that take?
What's up?
How long does that take to do 100?
Yeah, 108 breaths, less than a minute.
Less than a minute.
Second version is like what Wim Hof does, which he'll do longer time periods with open mouth breathing. So he's getting a lot more air in for a lot longer, which creates a more noticeable state change. And I think one of the big reasons why he's gotten results, but also gotten a lot of notoriety, is he's kind of taking something that is traditionally administered in a smaller dose and extending both the intake and the effects felt. So his is, More breath coming into the chest, not just the abdomen. Longer breaths for more time, and through the mouth instead of the nose. The last one is if you've ever done Kundalini breath, it's similar. It's slower breaths, but it's called circle breathing. So there's no gap in between an inhale and an exhale. What I mean by that is there's no time when you aren't either inhaling or exhaling. So at the top of the breath, you're immediately going to the bottom of the breath, immediately going to the top of the breath. And people do that for like an hour. And you get some of the same experiences that you get on LSD or ayahuasca. If you ever go through like a rebirthing kind of facilitation or experience, or any kind of like major trauma release without substances, it's typically done with breath. And what it does to the body is it puts you in such a state of fight or flight, it makes you think you're dying. So it releases the same types of chemicals that are released when you take like a DMT or when you're near the end of your life.
Just from breathing.
Just from breathing, yeah. So, yeah, and that's the incredible thing about the human body and human mind is you can achieve all the states that you can achieve through the shortcuts of drugs with yourself, with physical and mental action.
So this, so I'm assuming this is a facilitated thing that you would want, like a coach walking you through like an hour of breathing in this way?
Yeah, it should be. I mean,
yeah, that doesn't seem like you want to do it on your own.
Try it. I don't recommend that. When I did it, it was in Bali, and someone was like, right there with me. Not to freak anyone out, but what starts to happen is you lose control of your extremities first. So you start kind of clamping up and like protecting your chest. So like you can't move your fingers, they curl in. Can't move your wrists, forearms, biceps, they all they constrict and they harden. Same thing starts to happen with your legs. You might feel cramps. What happened for me was a big purge. I was letting something go. So I was coughing. I was crying. I started vomiting. And then after that was out, it was like a idyllic kind of like a heavenly kind of experience where, there's some separation from the body and some visions of my past and, people that I talked to and worked through stuff with and let go of. So it was, and through that experience, my facilitator was helping to massage my hands that were cramping, helping to console me, telling me it's okay, to keep going or it's okay to stop if I want to stop. And the other people that were doing it at the same time, some would stop before they were vomiting, some would stop before they had those, kind of like psychedelic experiences. But me and one other girl went all the way, went deep.
Does that mean like hit the, is there a timer on that they suggest that you go towards or go all the way, meaning like you actually have that like transcendent experience?
It's going to be a different time for everyone. Everyone's body's chemistries and like capacity for this kind of thing is different. So some people might hit it in 15 minutes. Some people might take 45 minutes. It's more of you'll know kind of where they are in the process based off of what, what's happening with their body it's less of a time thing and more of like a what state they're in kind of thing.
That's bizarre. So you're literally like your whole body tenses up like it's protecting you in some way. Like, is that like the fight or flight? Like, you are literally like something's not right and your body just responds.
It's like the fetal position. So any kind of like serious shock, like you'll see people curl up like an egg, right? And that's why they put the like gravity blanket around people to like console them. Is that, I mean, that's like the womb, like a warm surrounding in the fetal position. So it's, yeah, I mean, I wasn't like, oh, it's time to protect myself. It was like my body was just naturally
just reacting.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I didn't know that. I didn't know that existed.
Yeah.
So where do they, all right, from my experiences so far, I would say that is definitely a facilitated event.
I mean, definitely don't try it at home without supervision.
I would say, the same thing with psychedelics. It's, yeah. You know, obviously there's recreational use, but if you're going to do it for other purposes, for growth, for any of that, like just get a shaman, get someone that knows what they're doing, that's trained in it. I want to try that. Where did you get it done?
It was actually a retreat that I was a co-facilitator on. I had two partners in it. They had both done it before. So they were like, hey, we'll take facilitation for this. You should do it with everyone, like all of our guests. I was like, no, it's fine. Like, you know, I'm like working this, I'll help. And they're like, no, like we think you'd benefit from it. It was like kind of like a soft nudge of like, do this.
Yeah, dude, you need this thing. Check it out.
And I'm glad they did. Yeah, shout out to Chelsea and Megan.
That's so interesting. Was there a long process beforehand? Was there a lot of meditation and maybe like a little bit of talk therapy or anything along those lines? Or was it kind of just go for it?
Yeah, we did it on New Year's Day, 2020. And we had 5 days leading up to where we were doing yoga twice a day. We were doing a lot of activities in nature. And I don't think I really understood it prior to doing it. But they were like, this is going to be our big, like, grand finale. This is what, you know, what people are going to talk about and why they come back and that kind of thing. And I was like, yeah, whatever, it's breath work. It's a powerful experience.
That's incredible. So what, you know, I've met a lot of people and there's people that search for this stuff. People that are out there and they're like, okay, what can I do to stretch my mind, my body, my mental capacity to another level? And then somehow like these things just pop up. It's like, okay, yeah, I'll try that. And that's kind of like my path a little bit. And, you know, it's not, I find that in some people really have these giant traumas that they're trying to get through and they're searching for solutions to get through these giant traumas. I find that the path is very different for everybody when it comes to doing big events like these. You also did like a long meditation retreat, didn't you? One of those like 7 day silent meditation retreats.
Yeah, it was not a retreat in like the Western sense. Okay. There's a monastery that is always accepting people in Chom Thong, Thailand that I just showed up at and got a kuti, which is like a little monk hut. And stay there for about a week.
So what is it that drives you to these uncomfortable situations?
Yeah. It's not me. Like I'll start there. I'm not seeking this stuff out.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm, you know, I don't have like a list somewhere in my office here where I'm like, check, like I did it.
Right.
I'm very anti goal, anti objective, anti bucket list. I'm not an outcome based person. It's intention. So like I have the intention of putting myself out there and connecting with people. And especially when I was in my 20s, I traveled to 34 countries alone and met a lot of people and just got like, I had a lot of doors open for me and some of them I walked through and some of them I said, no thanks. And, I think what's led to a lot of these types of experiences is trust and faith in something bigger than me. and that that thing, whatever it is, God, universe, nature, that's calling the shots, and establishing a fate like, you know, or destiny like path for each individual. And that sense of individual or self is an illusion. So, you know, in the same way that the rainforest has its own food chain and cycles of rain and rebirth and all the things, we're just one big forest. I mean, the earth is one big organism. There's no humans are destroying the earth. It's like, no, we're part of it. I mean, that we're doing what humans do. And the earth is doing what the earth does, and animals and plants and everything. Like, it's all one thing. It can't be separated. So, like, accepting that, having trust and faith in that, and going with the flow of life is what's led to the most interesting and impactful experiences of my life.
Like going with the flow. You said it right there. So these experiences come up, these opportunities come up, and it's like, does this feel right or not?
It's a process of unlayering. It's how much my ego can I strip away? So it's not like me, Matt Thomas, wants to win this Forbes award. Me, Matt Thomas, wants to sell out this stadium. Me, Matt Thomas, you know, it's like, what, you know, who is this vehicle? What is this ego? And what role does it play in this larger story that, that the world's telling or God's telling? And the more that I can accept that and flow with that, the better life is. And the more that I try to, like, control things and manipulate things and change things, the more this, you know, shit fucks up.
Dude, that is so accurate. And I've noticed the same thing in my life. As soon as it's like purpose, as soon as the purpose is to serve myself, I tend to hit brick walls with my face. And whenever the purpose is to serve others or to serve a bigger purpose or to serve just like whatever your experiences might whatever happens, then you tend to flow a lot better. You tend to get into like a flow state. And I've always kind of hated the mentality that people have that humans are destructive in some way. Like, sure. Okay. We are destructive. My 15-month-old is fucking destructive, but in the end, to separate humans from the planet or anything like that and to point fingers and to blame and play like the planet is victim to humans in some way, I don't think is the right way to look at it.
Eric, hurricanes are destructive. Tornadoes are destructive. Tsunamis are destructive. Forest fires are destructive. Forest fires were happening before humans were, you know, like, you know, having mansions in California with bonfires. You know, like it's part of nature's cycle, destruction and rebirth. In India, for thousands of years, they've worshipped Shiva, the goddess of destruction, for the purpose of rebirth. Things fall apart so that they can come together. And some humans might be a force of destruction. Some humans are nurturers and rebuilders and, you know, like there are both. So to label all of one category as one thing is not right. There's an element of duality in every culture, every religion. There's karma, there's yin and yang, there's the golden rule, there's exchange, and in order to have one good thing, there needs to be an equal opposite.
Mm-hmm. So, and this is how much of this mindset, this is exactly what I've seen repeatedly, is this mindset play a huge part in people's creativity. Some of the people I talk to that I find that can get these ideas that come to them and then they can execute with purpose and with flow, it tends to come from a mindset of something like you're talking about. How much of, you know, chess boxing, you being on a reality TV show, Brawl for a Cause, Fight and Flow, which we still need to get into. How much of that do you find just like an inflow creative cycle that stems from this type of mindset?
I think to circle back a little bit, I think it's an unlayering, a stripping away and creating space. which is a process that meditation can help. It's sifting through the past trauma and baggage that we carry. It's sifting through the future anxiety and worry that we put on ourselves. And it's getting into the present moment with as much space and openness as possible, to where we aren't trying to control things. We aren't trying to change things. We aren't trying to remember or misremember. We're just being. And in that state of openness with space, space is filled. And it's, in my opinion, filled by the divine. Because the God is in me, it's in you. Whatever it is, it's in everyone else. And so when we aren't trying to do our own conscious monkey mind maneuvers, and we're open, those signals are there all the time. It's just we're constantly distracting ourselves. So if we're open and we have space, those signals are a lot easier to be like, oh, that's a sign. Oh, that's an idea. Oh, that's aligned with this life and this ego and this body that, I need to do that. And for me, the clearest examples of that are things that follow the same mental pattern. You know, chess and boxing, two antithetical things that go together. Fight and flow. The fitness concept that you said that was my other COVID kind of project, but I've really been working on for about 8 years. That's martial arts and yoga. Two things that seem antithetical, peace and war, but really go together. And they've been done in tandem, especially in the East, for thousands of years. In terms of making it westernized and modern, it hasn't been done yet. But it is being done, just not formally or with a LLC, attached to it. So those types of expressions in my life, fighting and philanthropy, with Brawl for a Cause, it that's what like this human is doing with this life. So the more that I can kind of take my hands off the controls and just let it happen, the better.
How do you get there?
I mean, every day. It's hard.
Just to practice,
yeah.
Routine.
Yeah, it's hard. It's not like a... It's from one perspective, it's like a do less kind of mentality. Like stop striving, stop doing, find a meditation cushion and be. Get to know yourself in order to uncover some sort of purpose or meaning in your life. And then it'll flow in. And on the other hand, it's active work to be able to do that. Seeking out resources to learn how to meditate, talking to people that have been able to have moments of non-ego or non-striving, and how that's affected their lives. So it's effort and ease, it's the same kind of duality thing. And it's, I think a great vehicle for it is yoga, and not the Western yoga where, they jack up the temperature to 105 degrees and have you do asana, but yoga combines asana, the physical practice, pranayama, the breathwork practice, dhyana, the meditation practice, and five other limbs of yoga that are how you interact with others, how you interact with yourself. It's a way of living life that resembles religion, but is fully focused on what I believe is the only purpose in life, which is taking care of your vehicle. And part of taking care of your vehicle is serving others and interacting with the world in a respectful, peaceful, graceful, kind way. But if everyone took care of themselves, we'd all be fine.
I have a thing over here that says, be the change you want to see in the world.
I got it
from. But that's, dude, I can't agree more. I wish I got into yoga. In 2020, I was 3 days a week doing like a yoga mobility practice. But what I realized, and it was awesome, right? Game changer. I've never felt at peace, especially going through stuff like 2020. It was It was incredible. That plus like some breath work and stuff. But what you're describing, I think for a lot of people, especially younger, it's kind of you're describing a bit of a euphoric experience. This idea of ease and effort a little bit, because we all grew up on this hustle culture of go, 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 you know, hustle, 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 make your money. You know, you see it, people on social media all over the place with their Corvettes and their cars and their homes. And it's inspiring exactly that, right? Like, look for these material things, look for the stuff that make you look cool and feel cool. What you're describing is the opposite, but the same in some way, right? You're still working, you're still moving, you're still hustling, but it's not your identity, right?
Yeah, I don't feel like I hustle. There's a lot getting done, but it feels like flow. Like I'm not putting additional pressure on myself to do anything. I don't consider myself a hard worker. Like I don't. And everyone's like, yeah, I'll outwork anyone in the room. Okay, go ahead. Like it's that's I think that's missing something. I think that's a hamster wheel. And I think it works for some people that have an objective in mind that leads to. And I just think, one, I have an issue with objectives and goals. And two, I think that living in an intentional way and just trying to experience this lifetime and be what it's supposed to be, even if that isn't in line with what your ego wants or what you think is cool, is the point of life. And it will lead to a lot more, contentness and happiness and meaning. If you surrender and accept and flow.
Surrender, right? Isn't that the challenge of this new decade?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Look, and for people that are like, you know, like that's nice to say, but it's really hard to do. And like, I'm not trying to sit in my ridiculous chair and talk about this. Like I don't struggle with this. Like the last 2 months, I've been working way more than I've ever worked in my life because I decided to start two businesses simultaneously that are both hitting at the same time. And so, you know, I've lost elements of my personal practice that have led to me being less mindful in my interactions with myself and others, which has led to challenges in relationships and, more friction and fights than I'm used to. And I'm having to constantly recalibrate and reassess and understand what I'm doing and why. So it's not like I did it, I achieved it, it's all going to be easy from here on out. It's like every day it's the same mountain, and you keep taking steps. And some days you hit a snowstorm and your feet have frostbite, and you got to survive the night. And some days you're thriving and walking in the sun and it feels great. And both are going to happen, you got to accept it.
So it's about the journey. And you're not going to, you know, this euphoric idea of being present, right? Like what the fuck is that? You're not going to just snap your fingers and be able to do it. It's, would you say that it was a long journey just to get there, just to find that peace?
The nice thing is we can snap our fingers and be here.
Okay.
The trick is understanding that I need to know to snap my fingers and be here. The trick is not letting your mind run away in 15 different directions. And when it does, bringing it back. That's all meditation is. The way you start with meditation is samatha, which is a focal point. So you're breathing in and out. And then when your mind wanders away from your breath, you bring it back to breath. You're building a focal muscle. So you're being able to focus on one thing, which is in the present. Your breath is in the present moment. And once you once you get a handle on that, once you, just like a bicep curl, once you have enough repetitions and your bicep's strong enough, you can either increase the weight, so now you're counting breaths, or now you're doing a certain kind of breath for a certain, you know, iteration, or length of time, or whatever, or you're reassigning that focal point to something else. So the monastery that I went to, that I spent a week in, they did a very specific kind of meditation that changed my life, called Vipassana. And in Vipassana meditation, you don't focus on breath. You narrate everything that's going on in the physical, mental, and spiritual body. So you start with acknowledging all the physical inputs around you. And we sat in a very quiet room in a monastery, so not a whole lot was going on. You might feel a breeze or hear a bird outside, but there aren't a whole lot of like a physical world stimuli that are happening. So once you acknowledge those and you're just acknowledging your breath, inevitably mental constructs start coming up. And what I mean by mental constructs are, you know, things from the past, things from the future, planning, striving, and you can start to acknowledge these things almost like an audit. And the first step to change, any type of change, is acknowledgement. I'm having these negative financial habits. I acknowledge that I have too many monthly subscriptions. I acknowledge that I eat out too much. I acknowledge, like, you're stating, you're writing down on paper, you're putting on a spreadsheet that there is something. And you can call it an issue, you can call it something you want to change, but you're just saying there is. Once that happens, then you can start to actually dig into it. And so the beauty of Vipassana is you start to pattern recognize what your mental constructs are. You know, maybe how obsessed you are with getting a Tesla keeps coming up again and again and again. Now you have a journal prompt. Why do I want a Tesla so bad? Is it because Teslas are cool and I want people to think I'm cool? Is it because I believe in green energy and I want to be a part of the change of the future and that's a symbol of it? Is it because whatever? And then you can start to get to know yourself. Oh, this is something from my ego and something that might undermine me. Or this is something from a good place that I want to nurture and feed and follow. So one has to come before the other in meditation practice. You can't jump into Vipassana before you have that mental muscle of samatha and focus. But once you do, you can start to really dig into yourself, get to know yourself, uncover some sort of purpose or path, and then start to assign meaning to your actions and see if they're in line with that purpose or path.
So that's step one, acknowledgement. Sometimes I find that the best way to really allow something like that to sink in is to identify what the opposites are. What would you say the opposite of acknowledgement is?
Avoidance. I mean, apathy or avoidance.
Avoidance, aversion.
Either I don't care, therefore I won't acknowledge. Which is, apathy is very close to ease and flow. But it's a very different expression of it. So those can be tough to separate, but I care, therefore I'm in flow, versus I don't care, and whatever happens, happens, like a nihilistic kind of perspective on life.
Mm.
They're similar from the surface, but very different internally and intentionally.
So how do you know if you're in one or the other?
I don't know. I mean, if you don't feel care it? Because, like, you know, the world is evil and you can't control anything and, you know, nothing matters, versus you've done the intentional work of achieving, you know, a flow in the present. Those are very different people and very different paths.
Feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't accidentally stumble upon the good version of that. You might accidentally find yourself in the apathetic version of that.
So it takes putting in the work.
In my opinion, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whew. Okay. We're getting towards the end of the time here, but that was a really great little discovery we went on, I would say, from a perspective of trying to find mindfulness. Because it's this lucid thing for most people, right? It's like, what is mindfulness? It's not sitting alone. It's this other stuff that's going on behind the scenes. It's this other stuff that's happening in your mind. And I do find that place is where you'll find some creativity and momentum even. You know, sometimes it's really tough. You can get these stuck feelings that prevent you from going somewhere or doing something. But when you get into a mindful place, and I've been in both places plenty of times, and I can usually identify at this point, it's like, okay, this is, I'm coming from one of those negative places of aversion or ill will or whatever it might be. And it feels very different once you've felt the alternative.
Great.
And then, right. Cool, man. So, I don't want to take up too much of your time here, but I do want to close out by just your journey has led you to mindfulness and health and wellness and then also all this stuff that you're doing to impact other people and the world. And it's incredible. It's awesome. It's inspiring. It's great. I love it. And I think that more self-expression in this manner would be great for the world. I would like to figure out a way to get more people there, right? And not just, from listeners of this podcast type of thing, but like, how do you inspire? Cause I know that the people that you touch in your life, probably are inspired to do very similar things or inspired to get on board or inspired to figure out their own mind in such a way that they can, you know, access these types of peace and flow and all that kinds of stuff. I would like to, given your experiences, and I know that everyone's experience is going to be very, very different in life, and we all have different life experiences. Given your experiences, what are some of the, especially from a mindfulness and health perspective, what are some of the main target mindsets or, you know, I don't want to say goals because you said you're not like a goal guy. But like, yeah, what are some of the, I don't want like a 1, 2, 3, step one, step two type of thing, but so what are some of the mindsets that you can deliver in a short amount of time to listeners?
Take care of yourself.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, look, you're going to read a lot of stuff that, contradicts that and says, you know, like serve others, do for one what you wish you could do for many. Mm. Make yourself that one. It on the surface may seem like a selfish mindset, but what you just said, which I appreciate your kind words, of, you know, it's inspiring everything that you have going on. And that's what will happen. The positive ripple effect of you taking care of yourself and making sure that you are full and that you can overflow into others and making sure that you aren't a negative impact on someone else's life or day, that you're buying coffee in a bad mood and saying something rude to someone in line or the barista doesn't send them off on a negative cycle through the rest of their day. Instead, making sure that you're in a good place and happy and thriving and successful so that you brighten other people's day in the coffee line is the most important thing you can be doing. All your time, all your energy is poured into that. Because as it keeps pouring into that, you only have so much that you can take until you have to overflow into other people. And you have to make their life better and to help fill up their cup. So that positive ripple effect of taking care of yourself is what changes not just your life, but everyone's life around you.
Mm. Dude, I was introduced to that concept of the cup years ago, maybe in my 20s. And I remember it didn't, like, for some reason, it didn't sink in. It took so long for the idea of it to sink in. I don't remember the actual thing that made it click. And maybe it's one of those things that clicks and unclicks. But it's also a pattern that I'm recognizing that is true. Just it's to fill your own cup first and let it overflow.
I think it.
Which it sounds so selfish.
It may feel most true in the most important relationships in our lives.
Mm.
So you can look at your parents and when they did something evil to you in your childhood. When you get older and you have perspective of life and understanding that your parents are human, you understand that they weren't trying to hurt you. Parents love their children more than anything on the planet. They were suffering. And that suffering led to your suffering because their cup wasn't full. And, you know, by extension, yours was lacking. And then, you know, as adults, especially in romantic or life partnerships, it's a constant mirror and a constant filling and refilling of each other. And so a great way to get practice with this, if you're feeling like you're making progress, is to bring someone else into the equation. How do I interact with someone who is working on themselves in the same way that I'm working on myself? How can I support that person while maintaining my person? And that's a really powerful lifelong exercise. And I think the most useful part of any kind of relationship.
That's really interesting. I've never heard anyone put it that way. So it's you fill your own cup. You are this tribe of one, creating fulfillment for yourself, and then you add another tribe member. How's it go? What can you see? What conflicts arise? Explore these things, and that's really interesting. And it's an ongoing journey from there.
You're looking in a mirror. Whenever you look at anyone, you're looking in a mirror. You're gonna get what you put into it. Whether that's an image of yourself or your past, or whether that's a certain action. If you flick off a mirror, what's happening? It's the same thing that happens out in real life. You treat someone poorly in the coffee line, you're gonna get that back. It's karmic.
Man, we can go down that rabbit hole too, because I think that's a topic that I've explored myself, as far as like looking into a mirror when you interact with other people and all that. And it's it's a tough one to unpack. And I think we could talk for an hour on just what that is and what that means, and pull in a psychologist and a philosopher and get deep under that rabbit hole.
This is an unpopular thing to say, but the core truth to that is it's always your fault. It's always my fault. Whatever's happening, like how can I take radical responsibility for whatever's happening in my life? Because you can blame other people and other things all day. You can blame circumstances and other people, but your life is a reflection of you.
Can you expand on that?
Yeah, the way that the thoughts that you cultivate, the actions that you take, manifest in the world around you. It is always my fault. Whatever's happening. And even if it's always my fault for 1% of what's happening, I'm taking radical responsibility for that 1% and figuring out how I can tweak and change that 1%. What was I focused on that led to that 1% of negativity?
That's a lot for people to take, though.
Take it.
Right? Especially people that have been in this victim mentality or something, or if something really, really bad happened to them. I had a guest on last week, Candace Mama, where she grew up in Africa. Her father was killed Her father was killed. He ended up being burnt alive in a car and then shot. And she had to confront the killer years later. This is after her body was already like destroying itself. She was going down this rabbit hole of negativity, and she could feel it physically and she could feel it mentally. She was depressed. And finally, she went through this healing process that led to her confronting her killer, her father's killer, and creating empathy for him, compassion, and all these different emotions of forgiveness, and actually doing the act of forgiving. I think that she actually gave him a hug by the end of it, of her own father's killer. But, man, to get from the place of, and she even said it was quite a journey, and to get from the place of, I'm a victim, from the place of like, I'm a victim of experiences, the victim of the world, to a place where this all happens for you, regardless of how shitty it might be. And, I don't want to ridicule anybody if they feel that way, because I do understand that some experiences are really hard to come back from. But, in the end, she was able to do it afterwards. And now she built a career off of explaining and trying to teach people how to forgive. And when it started with that forgiveness, but it was, she took responsibility for everything that was happening to her, everything that was happening to her body. And it's like that Jocko Willink extreme ownership, but it's like turned around on you, not to this external organization or whoever it might be.
100%. Yeah, that's an example of a woman living in Dharma, living her Dharma and purpose. Look, she couldn't control that someone killed her father when she was young. What she can control is how she responds to it.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone has their version of that. You know, my parents divorced when I was 9 months old. I had no say in that. But that shaped the course of my life. You know, and the way that I interact with my parents, the way that I interact with myself, those decisions, those micro decisions, those subconscious actions manifest my life. I mean, that's what makes my life experience the way it is. So I'm not trying to kick anyone while they're down, saying it's your fault. It's an encouragement. Get 1% better every day in how you respond to your trauma. And everyone has their brand of it. Everyone has their magnitude of it. I'm not trying to judge anyone else, anyone's. I'm not trying to say that it's not real and it's not valid, whatever you're feeling. What I'm saying is do better, respond better, and it'll get better.
I love it, man. That's some real stuff right there that is going to, it's going to be hard to unpack for a lot of people. Honestly, it is. And it was hard for me to unpack a long time ago. And it still is every day. Like, I still get trapped in these like places of this victim mentality or something, like the world is happening in some weird way against me. And then it's like, wait, Eric, remember your positive psychology. Remember all these things. Sometimes it takes some journaling, some yoga, some meditation. And then you start realizing that you can live more in the other way of it, not the...
Yeah, this is the best thing you can do for yourself.
Is that your journal?
Pen to paper.
Yeah.
That's that audit. I mean, that's the acknowledgement. Because it can be hard to wrangle a bunch of things bouncing around up here. It's a lot easier when it's down on paper.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree, man. Journaling is one of the best things, one of the best routines I've started. Dude... this has been an amazing conversation. I love learning. There's my dog right there. He just decided to open the door and walk in. Get out of here, Drogo. And I really appreciate your time. I appreciate your insight. It's been absolutely incredible. I hope we can have you on again sometime.
Yeah, anytime.
I feel like there's a lot more we can unpack, a lot more we can talk about. Is there anything else you wanted to add before we end, and then kind of end with like, where can we find you? Maybe let's plug, some of the stuff you're working on.
Sure. Yeah. Happy to come back anytime. Nothing else to add except for there's plenty more to talk about. If anyone's curious about anything, you can reach out at matt@brawlforacause.com is my email. My Instagram and most of my handles is @movingwithmatt, all one word.
Moving with Matt.
I appreciate your time and your interest in the platform. Thanks, Eric.
Cool, yeah. And we'll put all that stuff in the show notes, too, so people can take a look and check out Matt Thomas.
Cool.
Good stuff, man. Thanks again.